Hi, everybody, and welcome to the $10 Left on Red for April. You might be saying, hey, it sure is pretty late in April for the first Left on Red for April. And to that, I have to say to you that Patrick O'Brien's books, while awesome, are also very long.
Yes, what we've done is we've committed ourselves to reading a 20-novel series in which every novel is both quite long and also filled with a lot of unwieldy naval terminology. And as such, it takes the time that it takes. Please, relax, enjoy your time in the $10 patron exclusive premiere lounge, and we will have your podcast when it's ready.
Yes, that's right. This is what this is. This is the Patrick O'Brien Left on Red episodes are like the desserts that you have to order at the beginning of the meal because they take 40 minutes to make.
I was reading the Truman Capote essay, La Côte Basque, 1965, and there's a bit in that where the maitre d', American naturalized British Duchess orders something so complicated that the maitre d' tries to beg her out of it because it's so much work. And this is very much what all of you are doing by allowing us to continue reading the Aubrey Maturin series.
Yeah, well, you have ordered not just
you've ordered the souffle Furstenberg, right? And it's gonna create a whole sort of chaotic thing behind the scenes in the kitchen.
You haven't just ordered an ortolan. You've ordered a deconstructed modern take on the ortolan.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I hope you're all covering your heads with handkerchiefs as you listen to this to hide your shame from God.
But then it turns out that the handkerchief is made of spun sugar and you're actually supposed to eat it after. And we only tell you that subsequently. And then it's oh, what's this? The broth, the sort of cognac that you drowned the ortolan in, then goes to flambé a pineapple, which came from a tree that the ortolan was raised in. And the dessert is just called circles.
On knowledge and belief, because I haven't seen it, this is what the menu is like.
I mean, a little bit, yeah. They just, it's a movie I have mixed feelings about because I was you've really satirized fine dining very well, but I feel like a lot of the conceits when it becomes quite fantastical aren't really earned. But this isn't Kill James Bond. This is the Left on Red. And I need to tell you something.
Please.
I loved Post Captain. It was so fun. There was one bit of it that was weird, and I think we all can agree on which bit it was.
There's a few little weird things. There are a few notes that I've highlighted in my sort of my copy that are are you sure you can be saying this? But in general, I very much enjoyed it, right? Because Post Captain, the second in out of 20 of these Aubrey Maturin novels, is taking a bit of a break in large part from boats and men and men of boats to just kind of detour into a bit of Jane Austen pastiche. And I've found that I was never an Austen fan, I was never a Brontes fan at school, and it's not because I wasn't interested in Regency courtship, right? Because I apparently very much am. It's that I needed to get it through the lens of a naval grognard. And if you say the words male socialized to me at this point, I'm banning you from the Patreon.
If you know what it is I think you need the kind of delicate sensibilities, but you need the sort of very mannered world of sort of Austen and the Bronte sisters to be refracted through the through the lens of an oaf.
Genuinely, I need my sort of Virgil sort of guiding oaf.
Yeah, because we can't have Mr. Darcy being sort of stiff and the story of Mr. Darcy being sort of stiff and formal and difficult to talk to, refusing to dance and very proper and so on and so on. Mm. You know, that's there's nothing missing there. It says, wow, what a dour and serious man. Whereas when you replace Mr. Darcy with
a guy who tells a joke way too loud about shagging and then trips over the punch bowl.
Yes, precisely. And have him be in multiple balls before basically being chased to go to debtor's prison in what is some of the funniest slapstick that I have read in a long time.
It's really funny. It's another thing that I wasn't expecting about this book or the series in general, really, is that there's a real gift for comedy in there.
Yeah, so what I want to do, right, because it will be so easy for us to do the next 55 minutes about the first 150 pages where it's just Jack and Steven. Yeah, the fun, the funnest bit. The rest of it's also a lot of fun, but the funnest bit is where, like, Jack and Steven are, and Jack and Steven are living as two best friends.
Mm-hmm. We've established these characters in Master and Commander. You have Jack Aubrey, the kind of terrifyingly brave naval commander who is an oaf in every other respect, and Stephen Maturin, the doctor naturalist, sometimes spy and rebel, who's sort of like busy like INTJing his way through the situation. And now that we've done that, we have just like transplanted them into Pride and Prejudice. That's a really, really good setup, but it's not the only thing this book has going on.
So that is the inciting incident. I'm just going to kind of run through kind of the plot points so then we can go through them at our leisure. We start here, and we have love interests that are established as some ladies of marriageable age from a nearby stately home. Notice these two guys and their three servants have moved into a nearby, another nearby, like, gentleman's home.
The reason why this has happened, by the way, is that as we had the end of Master and Commander, where Jack has been very successful, he's become very wealthy off his prizes that he's successfully taken, and then, despite his best efforts, peace with France has broken out. And so, with nothing to do, and on half pay, he just kind of takes a manor house with this, like, with the proceeds to move in with his heterosexual life partner and five or six sailors as servants. And my favorite detail about this is, as this kind of like local, like, English rural society is trying to like look these guys over and be like, what's their fucking deal? Are they marriage prospects? You know, are they foreigners? The abiding thing is, because they're sailors and because all of the servants are sailors, the house is meticulously clean because it's being treated like a ship. And so this poor English manor house is getting like holy stoned and painted every day of its life. And so everyone who goes around is like, yeah, they seemed pretty weird. Like, Dr. Maturin was like dissecting a horse in the drawing room, but like everything was really like whitewashed.
And the funny thing is, that's not just something that you've pulled as the kind of example of what would happen. It's something that a character notes when they're walking by. It's just very nice and very clean, but that Dr. Maturin was dissecting a horse in the drawing room. I think the whole point of this first segment is to establish just how uncomfortable Jack and Steven and indeed like their men are with what could be considered like normal, settled life.
Yeah, and this is a point the book comes back to a few times, is, you know, land has all of these complications, right? It has, society has all of these entanglements and strangenesses, and in some ways, the kind of brutality and different strangeness of naval life is simpler and easier, particularly if you are a sort of God's perfect oaf.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, like so many things, you know, Steven is much more capable on land. That's true in this book as well as in the first. And, you know, this is, it's explored in different ways. As we find out, sort of as the book goes on, we've completely retconned Steven's character from a sort of itinerant traveling surgeon and former Irish freedom fighter who's principally concerned with Ireland to an intelligence asset of the British state, who was formerly an Irish freedom fighter who is primarily concerned with Catalan independence.
Yes, we make some little adjustments because as O'Brien sort of goes from writing the first novel, which is kind of intended to stand on its own, to realizing, oh, hey, I can like just do a bunch of these and explore these a bit more. We have to slightly change. Not really Aubrey. Aubrey comes out pretty like fully formed, but we have to change Stephen Maturin a little bit. And he has to become not epic. He's still like in many ways a bumbler. He's like, but he has to become more socially adept is the thing.
My favorite Steven moment in this book, it might be in fact one of yours as well, is when so if you recall towards the end of the next book. Now, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm going to keep going through kind of the beats of the story, and then we can go back and expound on what we choose. So we have this, we have our love interest established, Jack throws a ball, and then we have this love triangle where they're both sort of very taken, or they are love,
it's
quadrilateral.
Sort of a love, it's a love quadrangle, right? Because there are three eligible daughters, one of whom we rule out entirely, also a kind of like shrewish, socially climbing mother. Again, it's just pure Austen, right? And we have of the two eligible sisters, we have Sophie Williams, who is the kind of like pure at heart, maybe a little naive, desperately earnest, described all the time as pink, very pink, sort of very flushed. And then we have my favorite character in the whole series, Mrs. Diana Villiers, who is a sort of like, she's a young widow. Her husband was an army officer in India who has been killed. She's like
killed at the ripe old age of 18 and a half in India.
Yeah. And so she's like come back and is sort of like also a bit of an outsider in this like rural English society. Mm-hmm. And they see her while they're on a fox hunt.
By the way, just to be clear, well, they are badly bungling a fox hunt.
Yes, because Aubrey is a kind of enthusiastic but unstrategic and fundamentally sympathetic to the fox hunter, and because Maturin is just observing the whole thing quite dispassionately.
Mm-hmm. In his gun holsters was a dormouse he intended to dissect and a little bit of a snack. Which again, that's actually quite discontinuous with
worse. It's not a dormouse. It's a dormouse and like a tumor he has like excised from someone.
But that's strange because he becomes much more deadly as the book goes on.
Mm.
And maybe he's just a creature of his situations, but he's, you know, shown to be a kind of crack shot with a pistol, expert duelist.
Yeah, he's as much of a bumbler as he needs to be for that scene.
Yeah, he has a little bit of. And I don't fault Patrick O'Brien for this. I'm not like, I don't want literary science. He has a little bit of like plot competence,
yes.
I think, where he's kind of as much of a badass as he needs to be for what the plot needs to be at that moment. But I think having too much of an issue with that, it wants to take the fun out of reading, because it's really fun that everyone expects him to kind of be, you know, and again, like they love him on the boat. He's kind of a sort of mascot, sort of, but then to have him be able to turn around and like shoot the head off the King of Hearts from, you know, some 20 paces is quite fun. So you forgive Patrick O'Brien a little bit of plot competence flexibility.
Yeah, you can kind of tie yourself in knots, as I did on our first try in recording this, trying to like understand the way this is presented and try and like fold all of these aspects into like one cohesive description of Stephen Maturin. And I think, yeah, your attitude is the correct one of like, just relax a little bit.
Yeah. Now, all of this is going very, very well, right? Mm. Everyone's happy.
Yes.
And because the book doesn't end there, that can't be allowed to continue. Jack, like so many things, is very impetuous and rash, and without having the money in his hand from his prizes, borrowed all of the money he needed, like £11,000, to set him and Stephen and their servants up as country gentlemen.
Yes, because essentially he knows that he is due the money from those prizes. He knows it's going to come in. He has been assured so by his prize agent, the guy who handles all of his affairs, because to be a naval captain at this point, you have to be both a sort of like naval officer and also a bit of a like sort of mercenary to your accountant, and obviously this is going to be fine, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, and the book ends there. It's just 400 more pages of blank, blank, blank.
It's 400 more pages of Diana Villiers being described jumping a horse over a fence, and I'm just like reading very, very attentively.
She jumped a horse over a fence coldly and meanly.
Her form, her high-held head, her contained joy, competent, fierce gravity were as beautiful as anything Jack or Stephen had ever seen. She had not the slightest notion of it, but she had never looked so well in her life. There's another bit later on where she's described as having a certain piratical dash and openness, which was very attractive to sea officers.
And podcasters.
Yeah, and podcasters, the sea officers of the 21st century.
Yeah, that's right. As normal sea officers, no longer sea officers because they don't drink at work.
That's right. We start all of these off with like a shot of rum just to get things going a bit.
Yeah, the tot didn't stop. It just moved.
Podcasting's black tot day is going to be oof.
Yeah. So, right. We have our established wants, which is we have love, we have comfort, we have ease, yeah. But now...
And ostensibly, you have, like, you know, one sister for each guy, right? Like, particularly Maturin pursues Diana in a really, really, like... All of their scenes together are so good because they're so cold and so terse with each other in such a way that they're, like, obviously both thrilled by... They refer to each other by surname. I have a little, like, snapshot of dialogue here. Good morning, Villiers. You are late. You are very late. She says, it is the one advantage there is in being a woman. You do know I am a woman, Maturin. And I'm just like, this is perfect. This is absolutely perfect. I desperately need this, you know?
Yeah. I think you have COVID.
Yeah, I genuinely may do.
Yeah.
Like...
yeah. So this we've established kind of our stakes in our big catastrophe. Which is Jack's prize agent absconds. He was an unethical prize agent. He's sort of half of the Navy list, not half, but the sort of a great chunk of the Navy list has just been ruined by
and he's just
his,
gone to France with their money.
Yeah, basically.
And there's no extradition, even though it's peacetime. All of a sudden, sort of debt collectors and sheriff's officers are like knocking on the door of the manor house.
It is worth thinking here as well about sort of the, I think from modernity, and this is sort of explored a little bit in Master and Commander, but quite heavily in Post Captain, just how private the British Navy was.
Yes. Right. Yeah, absolutely. You had to have sort of your own means and you had to shift yourself. And like, in this respect, like the prize money was like the thing and it was entirely dependent on just your own private dealings with some guy who would advance you the money for it.
And not only is it that prize money is incredibly important, but captains are or masters and commanders and captains are expected to actually themselves fit out a huge amount of what goes on in the ship. Yeah, the Admiralty gives you some stuff. They give you like the cannon and shot and powder and sails, but you know, you have to lay on stores, you have to lay on water. If you want to hire a chaplain, that's kind of on you. You know,
it also spares no blushes about the number of bribes that are involved in this process as well. Like, fairly routinely in the course of this, Aubrey is, like, out of pocket, not just because he's had to fit all of this stuff in, but because he has had to grease palms to do it.
Yeah, he has to grease palms to get his ship outfitted properly. So that he can get the prizes. By having so many private incentives in the book, like, I think what's interesting is like having so many private incentives throughout your Navy created a great story, but also clearly created a huge amount of problems in running a Navy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the thing. I don't think it would be as compelling a story were the Royal Navy less anarcho-capitalist, were it less sort of like primitively accumulative, right? And, you know, were Aubrey just kind of professional officer doing an officer's job rather than, as it is, a kind of a gentleman sort of largely left to his own devices on this stuff, who just sort of happens to be in the sort of like relatively early days of an institution that's still coalescing, you know, and it has its sort of like its networks of patronage and its sort of like its ladders and stuff, but for so many things he's just kind of granted like so much autonomy and so much independence.
Well, it's also right, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me a little bit of sort of the like military organization in the classical world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Much of your pay as a soldier comes from what you pillage from Gaul or from like what you're able to take from Thebes or whatever. And your rank as a hoplite, a legionnaire, or, you know, God willing, an equus, or sorry, Jupiter willing, an equus. you know, all of these things are determined by your ability to pay for them. And the more you can pay and the more soldiers you can pay and outfit, you know, the better time you're going to have in the business of warfare. It underlines, I think, how so many things that we think of as sort of universal and eternal, like that modern states tended to have what we consider to be roughly modern armies, and there was a thing called the British Navy, and largely what's changed is the composition of the ships and the fact that you don't get drunk anymore. You know, it was actually so anarcho-capitalist. And I mean, the anarcho-capitalism goes beyond the organization of the Navy itself, also to the fact that by having so much sort of personal risk being taken by captains, it means that if their prize agent absconds, then you can lose a huge amount of like ship captaining experience to debtor's prison, and there's nothing you can really do about it.
There's also, on the other side of this, it's interesting to note that the law, the debt collection, the sheriffs, the tipstaffs, are also sort of largely unformalized. It's just like, in many cases, it's a mob of guys who are trying to like chase Aubrey to like fill this writ, and like by just touching him to like lawfully arrest him. And there's a great scene later on where he's cornered by these guys and he has to call his own crew for aid, and he turns it around and he just press gangs them by that force. And it's like it's like, oh, we have two sort of like ad hoc coercive situations here, and he just like has a kind of trump card of like, well, actually, you can't like self-appoint you can't appoint yourself a debt collector and arrest me because I am press ganging you, and now you are in the Navy.
I mean, this is what Patrick O'Brien did, I think, with that scene. Is it is a wonderful satire of that scene itself is a wonderful satire of the sort of just mad dysfunction of the Victorian state.
It's like a sort of Hogarth engraving in a lot of ways, you know? It's like Beer Street.
Constantly at odds with itself.
It's this very strange, like, surreal carnival.
I mean, when he leaps out of a window onto a haystack as these men are trying to sort of capture him and drag him away to debtor's prison. Well, to be clear, he's not like not got his ship at this point. He's been appointed the worst ship in the Navy by Admiral Hart as a kind of revenge.
Yeah, we gave him a ship that sucks as a joke. It's not exactly that, right? He goes to the Admiralty. He's like sneaked out of his manor house. Maturin helps like sort of like lay a false trail for him. And he goes to the Admiralty and begs for a ship. Well, actually, no. First of all, he demands a ship. The Admiral, speaking to him, says, "If your own imprudence has lost you the fortune your command allowed you to win, you must not expect the Admiralty to feel responsible for finding you another." And Jack gets mad, and he slightly argues, and he uses the word damned, the sort of like most minor swear word of the English language, which causes the sort of the Sea Lord facing him to say, "What the fucking hell is this language to me, sir?" And so he's sort of like, he's kicked out, and eventually what he's able to sort of like wheedle out of them, coming back with a more sort of contrite atmosphere, is this sort of failed experimental ship, HMS Policrest, which we're told was sort of like, it was built for firing a very large sort of permanently installed rocket system.
And it didn't... the Victorian, the V and V2 rocket stood for Victorian.
This is like way pre-Victorian. This is still Regency.
I've always said the Victorian state to refer to the 19th century. What I mean is the 19th century British state.
Yeah. And the thing is, it looks weird as hell. It sails bad as hell. As he's sailing it out for the first time, this voice goes up from one of the ships in the road. "What ho, the carpenter's mistake."
Also, my favorite detail about HMS Policrest is... that it, the sort of mad inventor who created the ship, was killed when he was trying to unjam a test fire in the rocket. It was just presumably blasted into the Irish Sea. As we say, he takes this command, and the command...
we've skipped over the fucking bear bit.
Oh God, yes. So this is So, sorry. You see, this is the thing about Patrick O'Brien, is you get swept away in the different little tides and eddies of the story.
Yeah, and you forget that there's a whole scene where Stephen Maturin leads Jack Aubrey through France and over the border to Spain in a bear costume, like on a leash.
That's a bit of an odd one. But one of my favorite scenes in the book actually takes place before that, which is, I love a We're Not So Different, You and I.
Yes, because they go to France to pursue this prize agent, right? In hopes of like finding him and like getting some of the money back.
Basically, doing the best thing that the law could offer you at the time, which is punching him until he gives you the money back.
It's back to that now, I understand. But yeah, they go to France and they pay a social call on a French captain that Aubrey has fought before, Captain Dumanoir. And they have this kind of very friendly sort of conversation where it's like, yeah, we're all bros here. Hopefully peace isn't going to like stick around for too long and we can get back to what we really like, which is killing each other. And Dumanoir gives them a sort of like heavy hint that like, hey, by the way, you should get out of town tomorrow because war's going to start again.
Well, this is the same captain who actually captured them at the end of Master and Commander, and where they seem to be at some of their happiest in his captivity. Because he has a fantastic, like, physician who's a surgeon who Stephen Maturin admires greatly. But one of my favorite scenes, one of my favorite little instances, is they're talking to the captain. Christy Pierre, the captain, read the note twice, clearing the fumes of brandy from his head and sobering fast. He was a massive bear-like man, not as tall as Jack, but stouter, and he could stand his drink. Broad, somewhat round-shouldered, with very kind brown eyes, but not foolish. And he came back to the table, carrying a pot of coffee. They were hard and piercing. All navies have their problems. My colleague who looks after them here is on leave, and I take his place. Here I have a description of a man in a black coat with a telescope on Mount Ferrand this morning, looking at our installations. Medium height, slim, pale eyes, bob wig, gray breeches, speaks French with a southern accent, and he's been talking to a Barcelona merchant. Why? Cried Jack. That must certainly be Stephen Maturin. I have no doubt of it. He has a telescope. One of Dolan's very best telescopes. I'm sure he was up there on Ferrand this very morning, because when I was out of bed gazing about for his precious birds, he mentioned some monstrous rare titmouse that lives up there. I wonder, he laughed heartily. He did not go up to the fort and beg for use of their big artillery instruments. No, no, he's the simplest fellow in the world. I give you my honor. Unspeakably learned. Knows every bug and beetle in the universe and will have your leg off in an instant, but he really should not be allowed alone. And as for naval installations, he cannot tell port from starboard or a bonnet from a drabbler, though I've explained it 1,000 times, and he does try to apply himself, the poor fellow. I'm sure it must be him, for what you tell me about his speaking to the Barcelona merchant in that language, it's definitely him. He lived in those parts for years and speaks their lingo like a native. Why, we're on our way down there right now to a property he has, and as soon as we've been across to the Porcarolas to see some curious shrub that grows on the island, and nowhere else, we shall move on. Ha ha ha, he laughed, a big voice full of intense amusement. To think of poor old good Stephen being laid on by the heels for a spy. Ha ha ha.
And Stephen, who of course is spying, is being
absolutely 100% a spy.
100% done in by his friend. But because they kind of depend on this like mutual collegial oafery to fight their wars, like Christy Pelliard, the captain, the French captain, is just like, well, if you give me your word of honor, then I guess I'd better like absolutely trust that.
Yeah. Oh, well, why didn't you say he was...
Oh, he's with you. He's like, yeah, of course. Like, yeah, you know? We're all gentlemen here, you know?
And then Christy Pierre's like, oh, they must have been too stupid to note he's just a surgeon and not a spy.
And then he's like, by the way, you should probably get out of town, though, because they will arrest him as a spy.
Yeah. Well, not just that. It's that every English person in France is going to be arrested because the war is going to be declared tomorrow.
These days, if you say you're English, you'll be arrested and thrown in jail.
And thrown under lock and clef. Mm.
These days, if you say you're English, you'll be taken below and clapped in irons.
I wanted a quiet life in the cutter. There's this strange interlude of
Stephen. I don't know, man.
Costume. I mean, I feel like this might.
He's pushed the comedy too far on this one. This is just
like
silly.
Just have him hide in a sack or something. They let's just say they make their way down to the Spanish border. Jack is disguised as a bear and Stephen is like a bear baiting guy. It takes, honestly, like I like a flight of fancy as much as the next reader, but it does take you out of it if it gets too fanciful.
Yeah, this is why we skipped over it. They get a ship back home just as war breaks out, and this sort of merchant ship, this armed but not very heavily armed merchant ship, and of course, war breaking out, they are forced to fight the ship, and Jack is placed in this like perfectly awkward position of being this sort of only fighting officer aboard, but still trying to respect the captain's authority. So you get things like, you know, him passing a message like, tell the captain with my compliments that there is not anything like enough 18-pound shot on deck kind of thing.
Yeah, he's backseat quarter decking, basically.
Yeah.
Captaining. There we go.
This is also the bit where O'Brien describes the ship as all smelling of brown men and violent emotion. And I wrote down, I don't know that you can write that, white boy.
So, yeah, this is the bits of this that remind you that, again, yeah, this book also was written by an English author in the middle of the 20th century.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it does also contain the phrase, the Lord Nelson fell off, to which I wrote, yo, for real.
Yeah, Patrick O'Brien just growing broccoli Zoomer hair.
No bicorn, for real, for real.
Fuck off. No wig.
No, wig.
This
is why people pay us $10 a month is for no bicorn for real.
What if Erdogan worked in a Morrison's? How about that, huh? You ever think of what that would be like?
You know, I so often do.
Yeah, okay, so they are once again the Lord Nelson, despite Jack's very, very polite poop deck captaining, is then taken by a French privateer that is described as, like, essentially like a cheetah, right? This lithe, sleek, fast, dangerous,
yeah,
sort of...
The Bologne. Like,
yes. And, you know, as per usual, when Jack and Steven are captured, their captivity tends not to last very long, as they are... the Bologne is intercepted by some English ships and is once again unable to outrun them, basically.
Yes, yeah. And you get the sense that this is sort of quite normal to be traded back and forth and paroled like this.
Mm-hmm. And so they return to England. They return to the South Downs first, to call on the ladies at Mapes, where, again, another very funny exchange happens, where Mrs. Williams, the sort of sour social climbing sort of mother who's trying to, you know, have her daughters marry well, finds out that what they didn't just go to sort of some friend of Stephen's in Spain on their adventure. No, no, no. They went to what Stephen describes as basically a tumble-down stone house that he keeps sheep in, but that is technically a castle.
Yes. He is sort of like... nominally a kind of minor nobility. His land is like sort of 4/5 mountain, but he has land. And as soon as she like hears at all of this, she's like, well, maybe he's not so foreign after all.
Yeah, look, he may be foreign to England, but he's not foreign to castles. So all this being done, Jack and Stephen must essentially relocate themselves to Hampstead. A little cottage in Hampstead, where, again, their two heterosexual life partners live together.
Yeah, in very close quarters, and this is where I have the note, in Jack's opinion, Stephen was little better than a slut. I realize slut here means untidy, but I still note it anyway because I think it's funny.
Yeah, they're in a DS relationship.
Yeah.
I mean,
kind of, in some ways.
A little, but who's which?
Mm.
There are sort of a few notes here in London. The third major thing that happens is, yes, Jack receives his commission to the HMS Policrest.
Yeah.
However,
and he's going to be safe from debt collectors if he can get aboard, because they can at least stop them from getting on the Royal Navy ship and like arresting the captain.
Well, this is sort of the third. This is what we've talked about, which is like the debt collectors, the slapstick, and the getting on board the ship. This is the third of three things that happens. The first two are, number one, Jack is mugged by the world's worst mugger.
Yes, Scriven, his name is.
A man who knows everything about escaping debt collectors. And because this is Regency, as you say, I can't believe I said Victorian, this is Regency England, like the state also, we get, hasn't been made to make sense yet. And so there are bits of the Duchy of Lancaster in central London that if Jack sticks to, he's safe.
The liberty basically. Of the Savoy. London writs don't count there. And so they would have to go through a whole different court system, and it allows... It's basically, there is a kind of city-state, yes.
Yeah, there's Hamsterdam, like from The Wire. Is it for like, indebted captains.
Yeah, so he goes to indebted Captain Hamsterdam.
Yeah. Where, and again, this...
You also say they leave Scriven alive largely because of another dysfunction of the sort of English administrative state, which is that if they hand him into anyone, he will be hanged. And, like, they're both, like, they're not sanguine enough about this to actually do it. So Jack having given him a massive clump out, like, upside the head, Stephen kind of nurses him back to health and is like, well, now you're going to be, like, useful to us, you know?
Yeah, don't rob us anymore. I guess you're kind of sort of in the Navy now a bit. We don't really see much of him after.
Yeah, get press ganged, idiot.
and so this occurs. The middle thing that happens, which I think gives the more interest and weight to Jack taking command of the Policrest, is that he meets George Canning, I believe a relative of the Canning for whom Canning Town is named, or is supposed to be a relative, a sort of a wealthy Bristolian merchant. Who trades in, never mind, I think is the, who's a slave trader, essentially, or would, as was slave trader, now, you know, general merchant of Bristol. Yeah. A bit of a, what was it, a merchant, a bit of an Edward Colston type.
This would have been towards the tail end of, like, legal slave trading in Britain, so yeah.
A man who maybe would have made his early fortune in the slave trade and now is getting out to other things.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the book sort of takes great pains as well. The book sort of takes great pains, but also the other thing about Canning is that he is Jewish.
Yes,
but because he is sort of a rich...
tuning in for the Jack Aubrey cultural sensitivity hour.
Yeah, well, the but again,
because
the Jack
he really
Aubrey,
he starts out really trying. He really likes Canning, and so like when he invites him to dinner, he like agonizes about whether or not venison is kosher, although he doesn't know the word kosher. So he's just vaguely aware that Jewish people have different dietary customs, and he wants to try and observe them, but no one can actually know. So his only recourse there is the ship's Bible. So he like goes through Leviticus trying to find out whether or not his guests can eat deer or not. And to be clear, this deer, just to give you an example of how fucking yokel English society was at this period, this deer is literal roadkill. They have killed it by accident in a cart on the way down, and they've just thrown it on the back because it's good eating.
Like we said, that's one of the things I love so much, and what I think is a really good example of a more mature O'Brien is he's much more comfortable with a comic voice.
Yes.
The book is not a comedy. It is still a kind of not sort of high seas, true to life, almost Robert Altman-esque drama, but there's so much humor in it.
I would describe this by genre as a kind of classic slice of life yaoi.
I mean, a little bit.
If I don't have a, like, Bishonen, like, Aubrey and Maturin on my desk by Monday, you're all fired.
Yeah. You're not all fired. You're actually paying to be here. We really don't want to fire you. But this is one of the things that I think I love so much about these books, is that they are not... It's a bit like The Sopranos. Not a comedy, but extremely funny.
Yes, yeah. Because you can smuggle comedy in that way.
Yeah. And mostly it's just these quite sort of serious and earnest characters in situations that they don't quite know what to make of, sort of doing their best earnestly and fully barreling down entirely the wrong direction in a forking path.
Yes. They're still trying to seduce these two women, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
So Sophie badly. Has like a sort of almost nearly engagement to some rural clergyman. And Jack is sort of like worrying about this because he describes Sophie as being as far out of his reach as an admiral's flag. And meanwhile, you know, Maturin and Diana are like hurting each other's feelings for fun.
Aubrey meets Canning at the ball, who says, hey, you know what? I'm extremely rich. I want to commission a bunch of privateers. I want a very reputable naval captain with his reputable naval connections to bring actual seamen onto the boat.
Yeah, you're done working in the like underfunded public sector. Take this private sector job where you get to do like the same thing, but you have infinite resources available to you. And the only cost of that is that you are, like, jeopardizing your career prospects in this sclerotic official bureaucracy.
Yeah, but Jack being too... So Jack is like, oh my god, this is an amazing choice. But you understand, Mr. Canning, if the Navy offers me a command, I must take what they offer me, because he is... At the end of the day, he is a company man. Unlike his father, who's just been elected to Parliament and fucking hates the Navy.
Yes, his father, General Aubrey, who exists largely as a complication, to be, like, getting up in Parliament and being like, my son, Jack Aubrey, told me that all of his bosses were dipshits. This is not true, by the way. It's just a thing that he's inventing. but yeah, if you want to talk about the cultural sensitivity, Al, because he's so tempted by this... and because he likes Canning, because he finds Canning sort of, like, genial and, like, patriotic and sort of, like, hearty, they get along quite well. They're sort of physically of, like, similar stature, which to like, Maturin is kind
guys.
Of important. They're big guys. Absolutely, they're big guys, and they love boats, and they get very enthused about it. And the really, like, heartbreaking line here is, this is Aubrey sort of, like, enthusing about Canning to Maturin after this ball. I took to Canning amazingly. I hope to see him again. You would like him, Stephen. Full of life, intelligent, gets the point at once, interested in everything, civil too, delicate and modest, perfectly gentlemanlike. You would swear he was an Englishman. It's like...
Oh, boy.
Oof.
Oh,
and that's
okay.
Entirely germane with the kind of, like, anti-Semitism that was, you know, absolutely unquestioned. In yeah. Regency yeah. England, to be like, yeah, this guy who functionally, legally, like, ethically is English, to just be like, well, of course he can't be English because he's Jewish. Like, that thing, like, naturally doesn't follow to Aubrey.
It is just such a... Because, like, there's, other than, like, Maturin and the French captains who are trying to kill him, you don't meet many other characters that Aubrey, like, likes.
Yeah. Absolutely, you know? And it's so brutal that he has, like, the chance of a genuine friendship here, and it's like, sort of ruined by both circumstance later on, and also, like, his own unthinking prejudices in a way that he hasn't been able to surmount as he was with Maturin, or as he was, you know, in Master and Commander with any of his, like, anti-Irish prejudice, right? And it's interesting, too, to see this kind of, like, older kind of anti-Semitism where it existed prior to, like, this idea of dual loyalty, where it's like, no, single loyalty, can't be England, I assume. Just
question mark.
Yeah, exactly. And it's absolutely, absolutely horrifying.
So let's skip.
And then,
back
then
ahead
he
to
then he
we
goes
were.
To the First Sea Lord. The First Sea Lord is like, right, you can have this idiot shit for dickheads as a joke. And and he's sort of, like, tormented about this. And he's like, well, you know, maybe I could be a privateer. And then he, like, of course, because he's a patriot and because he loves the Navy, he's like, give me the fucking dipshit boat for morons. It's described as looking so that you can't tell the, like, bow from the stern.
Yeah. And it has a sort of a very sort of clever sliding keel.
I'll read you his thought process while he's in this office. The Polarcrest was a theorizing landsman's vessel. She had been built by a gang of rogues and jobbers. She was to serve under a man he had cuckolded, Art, and who would be happy to see him ruined. Canning's offer would never come again. Lord Melville was no fool, and he was aware of most of these things. He waited for Jack's reply with his head cocked and a considering eye, tapping his fingers on the desk. This was shabby treatment. The Polarcrest had already been refused, and in spite of his effort with the rating, he would find it hard to justify himself with Lady Keith. Even his own conscience, well seared by years and years of office, gave an uneasy twitch. If you please, my lord, I should be most grateful.
Oh, boy.
Through absolutely gritted teeth, like, yeah, give me the shit boat for addiction.
Give me the fucking asshole boat.
Give
me the
fucking HMS asshole.
give me the ship that you built as a prank.
And this, I mean, it's sort of relatable to me to be, as you know, a trans person who still does not want to move out of Britain despite it getting worse every day, to be like, it is inexplicable even to myself, this loyalty I feel, but nonetheless, I do the thing.
You meet the first gender lord.
Yeah,
at the Tavistock clinic.
The best we got for you is, like, social transition is now illegal, and I'm like, guess I still won't move, though.
I'll still live in the joke country for idiots.
I literally will, yeah. And so he successfully gets to Portsmouth to see Pollocrest, and the best thing he can say of it is, she may be a little odd to look at to the prejudiced eye, but she floats, and that is the essential, do you see?
Because Jack will never speak ill of a ship he commands, and the Pollocrest really pushes him.
He says later on in his own sort of like internal monologue, he had sailed in some rough old tubs, ponderous things with no perceptible virtue to the outsider, but he had always been able to find excuses for them. They had always been the finest ships in the history of the Navy for some particular quality. And the Pollocrest just doesn't have one. Like, it sails like absolute dog shit. It goes backwards at one point. You get into your car, you put it in first, and it goes into reverse. You know, like, incredible stuff.
And also, it has no ranged cannons because it was designed only to fire a rocket.
Yes.
And so instead, you have to get, like, it basically has two shotguns on either side of it.
Yeah, carronades. It has, like, very, very heavy guns, but short ones. And so they can absolutely, like, wreck anything within the distance of, like, pistol fire. Anything beyond that, useless. Again, we have given you the joke ship for idiots.
Yeah, you could turn two enemy ships at once into essentially matchsticks if they're sitting very still right beside you.
Does it like sail very well to allow you to get up close to them like that? It does not.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So Jack sort of then is put on channel duty, some of the worst possible.
We should also talk about, like, because a surprising amount of this book is about like management, right? This is the sort of one of the interesting things is how much it is like manage, like sort of management simulator, right? Because specifically his first officer, his first lieutenant, is like a martinet, essentially. He's been made to have him against his will. And he's sort of like, God, what's his name? Parker.
Oh, Parker, who loves flogging.
Yeah, he loves flogging, motherfuckers. He's doing, like, sallow shit to people when you're not looking. Like, you leave him alone for, like, a day, and all of a sudden he's, like, having people gagged with, like, iron bars and stuff for fun.
Yeah. And again, there are sort of conflicts here, because, again, like, as we say, Parker is... Jack has a bad ship. He has a kind of... a crew of that's sort of, I don't know, maybe a quarter of them are okay seamen. Mm. Two debt collectors and a bunch of other landsmen. Like two just hapless debt collectors and a bunch of other landsmen. And then some of the old Sophie crewmates, as well as his servants from the house.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the whole book is about essentially the process and the mostly like failed process by which he attempts to turn these circumstances into an effective fighting machine.
Yes.
And yeah. It mostly doesn't work. In fact, like he routinely gets his shit rocked by Christy Pierre, I believe Christy Pierre at one point, right?
It's
Dumanoir. Yeah.
His original nemesis.
He kind of gets his shit rocked by Dumanoir, but like through some canny sailing, manages to avoid total catastrophe. But again, when he goes back into London after this, is sort of given the Macbeth. You did $20,000 worth of damage, $20 million worth of damage, McBain. The like, and do bring the Pollocrest back in one piece.
Yeah, because his commanding officer Admiral Hart is the guy that he cuckolded in the first book, and so any decision he makes will be the wrong one. It's for Kobayashi Maru hours. He like pursues Dumanoir and gets in this sort of like a gunfight with him instead of stopping a like small inconsequential smuggler's boat that turns out to have been loaded with like gold dust being smuggled that would have been like easily enough to pay off his debts. You know, like every decision he makes is scrutinized wrongly. And the only sort of real brotherhood he has at this point is, funnily enough, it's with Dumanoir. There's a bit where having like shot away all of their rigging with these carronades, but her colours were flying still, her wheel was unhurt, and on her quarterdeck, Captain Dumanoir waved his hat to Jack, shouting orders to his men.
Because also, it's not long after this as well that Stephen and Jack's relationship becomes quite strained due to the love quadrangle, And in fact, Steven is forced to demand satisfaction after Jack, in a moment of fury, calls him a liar.
Yeah, it's both the love quadrangle and also the fact that Steven is routinely getting tapped to do more and more spying in Spain. And I really like the description of his intelligence work here, because it kind of, I think it's a very well done portrait of the kind of alienation and like loneliness and sort of like almost automatism of, you know, you find yourself in you don't remember what country you're in, let alone what town you're in. You're sort of like in these sort of endless landscapes. You're questioning everything that's brought you there. He sort of like wonders to himself at one point, like, Catalan independence, for independence to do what? He sort of like, when he comes back, he can't speak to Aubrey about it. He tries to speak to Diana about it. And he's sort of like filled with this momentary temptation to just tell her everything. And instead he just sort of has to like bottle these things up and like do more and more laudanum that he's like prescribing himself about it.
Of course. And so at this point, Jack is unable to shake the suspicion that with Sophie gone, Jack thinks that maybe Diana Villiers is the one for him. And that, oh, now Steven and I are rivals for the same woman.
Yeah, and, Steven, who has been like sort of pursuing Villiers in a sort of like mutually self-destructive acid way.
Mm-hmm. Which, to be clear, is the only way I think would probably work, really.
Everything about her is like this, yes. And again, yeah. I love her as a character.
Yeah.
There's a bit where she like apologizes early on for like hurting his feelings. I'm trying to find it. Where she says, you know, like, there was like the phases of the moon or original sin or something, you know? And it's just like, their relationship is all like this. They hurt each other, they come back, they hurt each other, they come back. But every time there's this like creeping fear that like Aubrey is also pursuing Diana.
So this is in fact the passage where it all comes to a head.
Mm.
Dover, said Stephen and thought for a while, running the narwhal's horn through his fingers. Dover. Listen, Jack, you take insane risks going ashore often, particularly in Dover. Why particularly in Dover? Jack says, because your presence there is notorious. If it is notorious to your friends, how much more do you think to your enemies? It is known in Whitehall. It also must be known to your creditors in Mincing Lane. Don't look so angrily now, Jack, but let me tell you three things. I must do so as a friend. First, you will certainly be arrested for debt if you continue to go ashore. Second, it is said in the service that you cling to this station, and what harm that may do you professionally, you know better than I. No, let me finish. Third, have you considered how you expose Diana Villiers by your very open attentions in circumstances of such known danger? To which Jack responds, has Diana Villiers put herself under your protection as she commissioned you to say this to me? No, sir, Stephen replies. Then I do not see what right you have to speak to me in this way. But surely, Jack, my dear, I have the right of a friend, have I not? I will not say duty, for that smells of cant. And this is where we get to, I think, the coming together of the love triangle and the spying. A friend who wants a clear field, maybe. I may not be very clever, no goddamn Machiavelli, but I believe I know a ruse de guerre when I see one. For a long time, I did not know what to think about you and Diana Villiers. First one thing and then another, for you're a devilishly sly fox and break back upon your line. But now I see the reason for this standing off and on, this not at home, and this damned unkind treatment, and this cracking up of clever, amusing Stephen Maturin, who understands people and never preaches, whereas I'm a heavy-handed fool that understands nothing. It is time we had a clear explanation about Diana Villiers so that we may know where we stand. Maturin replies, I desire no explanations, they are never of any use, particularly on matters of this kind, where what one might term sexuality is concerned, reason flies out the window, all candor with it. In any case, even where this passion is not concerned, language is so imperfect that, and this is where Jack says something too far, any bastard can cowardly evade the issue by a flood of words, to which Stephen, growing cold, says, standing up, you've said enough, sir, too much by far, and you must withdraw. Jack cried, I shall not withdraw, and I will add that when a man comes back from leave as brown as a Gibraltar Jew and says he had delicate weather in Ireland, he lies. I will stand by that, and I am perfectly willing to give you any satisfaction you may choose to ask for. It is odd enough, said Stephen in a low voice, that our acquaintance should have begun with a challenge and that it should end with one.
Yeah, so now we have to fight a duel with each other. Mm.
Although, sorry, it's a very long passage, I like how you can sort of see Jack getting increasingly incensed and Stephen trying to dispel it without revealing what he actually knows.
There's a sort of, he does retract the bit about him calling him a bastard specifically, because he sends a messenger the next day. Captain Aubrey presents his compliments to Dr. Maturin and begs to say that an expression escaped him yesterday evening, a common expression to do with birth, that might have been taken to have a personal bearing. None was intended, and Captain Aubrey withdraws that word, at the same time regretting that in the hurry of the moment he made use of it, the other remarks he stands by.
This, of course, is not quite enough, and then it is known on the ship, on the Polycrest, that Jack and Steven are committed to seek satisfaction from one another.
Yes, which doesn't happen in this book. Yeah. They defer that duel. It just kind of, like, withers away due to circumstances.
It withers away largely because after a sort of, because they're, while they're about to fight, when things are at their worst between them, they are then sort of called to be, we learn that Spain is going to enter the war, and that England is going to send a number of ships to intercept some Spanish treasure ships and then sort of take a harbor. We can't fight our duel, Stephen, because we have to go do our duty for king and country now. And then the action there, which again is,
there is an intermediate sort of like heroic battle scene in which Jack is almost killed, in which he mercifully loses the Polycrest and also wins enough prizes that he is like able to sort of like recoup a bit and get himself a temporary command of a much richer man's much nicer ship,
and in fact is made post captain.
Yes, he gets his epaulette moved to the right shoulder,
and again the letter he sends Stephen at that point, where again they have not satisfied their duel, is, "Oh, Stephen, wish me joy. I've been made post captain," and Stephen is just willing to be like, "Okay, fine.
Yeah, I forget that I'm mad at you."
And then of course Jack also goes off to marry Sophie, who it turns out hated her parson.
Yes,
in the countryside.
Bad news for Maturin. First of all, we find out that Canning is like romancing Diana, which causes Jack to become briefly anti-Semitic, or more anti-Semitic, as a kind of like
more sort of actively anti-Semitic, as opposed to just the background radiation.
Yeah, he's described as like letting off a few like invectives about Jews because he's like seen them together, and it's like this is perhaps the most British man to have ever been depicted in anything. You know, there isn't a divorce court in the land like divorcey enough for Jack Aubrey.
At this point, I feel like the book sort of ends a few times, right? Because we wrap up our love triangle or love quadrangle enough that Jack is going to start having kids within a couple of books.
Yeah.
But also the war is back on, and Jack is going to need to be sent out again.
Yes.
So, you know, this is
he's so sweet and so earnest about this. Like he writes to Maturin, "I have the best part of a wife. 2 exclamation marks, viz her heart, 2 exclamation marks.
I mean, neurodivergent? It's possible.
Just very excitable. Meanwhile, Maturin happens to see Diana again at the opera with, like, some minor royal, and she's moved from this kind of, like, rural unconsciousness of herself and severity, which like Maturin finds very pleasing. And he says, "Diana's hands were still raised, and leaning forward, he watched with an even greater intensity. She was moving her right hand as she talked to the man behind her, and by Christ, she was moving it with a conscious grace." The woman that you are in love with has like become popular, and now you're really mad about it because you think she's a slut.
And Steven just virgin walks out of there.
Literally, he doesn't. He virgin sits in his chair until everyone else has left the theater, and they have to be like, "Hey, the show's over. You have to leave now."
And he's like, "You're cool. Don't come to opera tomorrow."
It is like genuinely pathetic in a way that I really like value, I guess. Like it's interesting to make a part of his character that he is so taken with her that he is willing to get this like pathetic about it.
Yeah. And so this is where we leave our sort of two heroes. I mean, look, we've talked to the plot of the book to death because it's so fun.
It's also a lot to fit into a strict hour as well.
Yeah. And I think I'm really looking forward to reading the HMS Surprise.
Yes. Yeah, me too.
However, I think we might take a month off of Aubrey Maturin novels.
Potentially, yeah. I think it's reasonable to space them out a bit. I really enjoyed this one. I really enjoyed Romance. I really enjoy Diana Villiers.
and that one lady really enjoyed the Speedo Man. Yeah, so I think what we're going to do for our next couple is November, you're choosing the next one.
I have an idea. I would like us to do a little piece of reportage. I want us to do Ryszard Kapuscinski's The Emperor, which is about the fall of the Ethiopian royalty and the sort of demise of the coup that sort of unseated Haile Selassie.
And then for the next one after that, I'm very keen on doing the book that the Saudi government had commissioned about Neom.
Hell yes. Because I like that author, too.
Yeah, that's why it's not a TF book, because it's not like MBS tried to write it himself.
Yeah, no, they hired a professional Israeli science fiction author to do it.
So that's the idea and how it's going to go. In the meantime, thank you so much for being a $10 Left Unread patron.
Absolutely. And listen, if you want to read a book about a severe woman, you could do a lot worse than this.
You could do a lot worse than host captain.
I hope that recommendation is worth $10 to you a month. I certainly think it would be to me.
November rates it 4 superior snarls out of 4. 4 Megaras from Hercules out of 4. Okay. All right. This has been like all of these, such a great joy. And I love talking about a book with you.
Oh, genuinely, yeah. It's always such a great time.
And yeah, well, I hope you all loved also talking about the book, and I'm sorry you couldn't get a word in edgewise. You listening. All right. All right. All right. All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.